So many different living things make our area the impressive place it is. Everything from big trees to tiny bugs. We'll focus on that smaller end of the spectrum today. Small but spectacular. The monarch butterfly is a resident of the region, and it has lots of human fans willing to go to some lengths to ensure the health of the species. Those include our first three guests today. Susie Savoy is a butterfly advocate, is one of the ways we describe her. Hi, Susie.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Good to have you here. Linda Kappen is, she reared monarchs at Applegate School for 12 years and grows milkweed for them. Welcome, Linda.
Hello.
And Tom Landis is with us as well. He's with Southern Oregon Monarch Advocates. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Are you guys all with Southern Oregon Monarch Advocates?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so I want to make sure we're clear on that point as well.
Anybody can be a Southern Oregon Monarch
It's a very
advocate.
Loose organization.
Well, let's get an idea then of what some of the major issues are with monarch butterflies, starting with your own interest in monarchs. And let's start with Susie.
Well, I am a native plant enthusiast, and I first fell in love with milkweed as a plant and propagated it from seed, knowing that it was a plant that the monarch butterfly needed for its larval stage, the caterpillar stage. And I grew milkweed. I've been growing milkweed at home for probably over a decade and have watched the monarchs lay eggs and the caterpillars and the chrysalis form, and throughout that time, a lot of the caterpillars were predated by wasps and other things. So this year, I, along with a lot of other folks with Southern Oregon Monarch Advocates, I started rearing monarchs in a rearing butterfly terrarium. And this year, I released and tagged about 80 butterflies. And Linda's going to talk more about the tagging program.
Okay, well, that brings up a great question. How do you tag a butterfly?
It's a tag that's about the size of a pencil eraser, and it has a sticky back, and it's made out of polypropylene, so it's very weatherproof. You get the butterfly and hold it by its thorax, and on the hind wing, there is a cell in the middle that's a mitten shape, and we put the tag right kind of near the body in the middle of that mitten-shaped thing, and it does not impede their flight. So whenever that tag is seen, people take a picture of it, and they email the address on it and report that they've found it.
So is there a number on it or some other information that's clearly visible to the eye or a camera?
How you keep track of them is a number on the tag, and there is and we tag with the Washington State University research program, and there is an email address on that.
Great. So if people should happen to see those, they can contact right away. All the information they need is right there on the tag.
Yes, and we have sheets that we keep track of everything on with all the info.
The tagging program is to monitor the migration of the monarch butterfly on the west coast. The monarchs west of the Continental Divide mostly overwinter on the California coast, so they're a little bit different. They're quite different than the eastern population that goes down to Mexico to overwinter. So there's less information known about the western population, so the tagging program is trying to gain more information.
Yes, and it also focuses on the biology and ecology of monarchs. And we do have migration movement that points toward Mexico in evidence already through Utah, and then observational evidence also.
So the tag, if it's as big as a pencil eraser, that's not insignificant in size for a monarch butterfly. How do you keep the weight down enough to keep the butterfly from flying in circles or something?
I think that it's just a very small percentage of their body mass weight. Mm-hmm. So.
It's 2% or less.
Okay, so very, very,
very
low
very
amount.
Small.
Lightweight paper, yeah.
Tom Landis, tell us a bit about what got you interested in monarch butterflies.
Well, I grew up in southern Kansas, and as a Boy Scout, I collected butterflies, and monarchs were everywhere. So when I retired and came to the Rogue Valley, I noticed one or two per year. They were very uncommon, so I started reading about it, and that made me aware that the population had crashed. And so I started, like Susie, about 3 years ago, I started in my backyard. I got milkweed, and now, just like her, we're raising milkweed and releasing monarchs. We released about five this week already.
So give us a historical perspective, because you just said the population had crashed. I mean, what do we know about the monarch numbers that used to be and what those numbers are now?
Well, in the late 90s was probably the population peak, both for the western and the eastern population. And the western population's down to 20% now of what it was 1997, I think, was the high point.
Really?
Yeah.
And do we have any idea why?
Yeah, there's several, you know, the scientists have studied it, and it mostly comes down to habitat. And habitat, as Susie said, is the milkweed needs the monarch needs the milkweed for the caterpillar. So we try and create habitat by planting native plants, nectar plants for the adults, and milkweed for the larvae for the caterpillars.
Monarch butterfly is the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange with Tom Landis, Linda Kaplan, and Susie Savoy. You can join us. They're all from Southern Oregon Monarch Advocates, and you don't have to be a member of the club to join this conversation. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. Maybe you have some experiences with monarchs in your own neck of the woods, or you've grown some milkweed in your yard to attract them. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Linda, I want to come back to you because I'm curious about the story of rearing monarchs at Applegate School for 12 years. Did you teach there?
Yes, I'm an educational assistant there, and started a butterfly habitat about 15 years ago. And made it monarch-friendly with milkweed. And just the very year after we did it, we started having monarchs and able to take them in the classroom and they can watch the life cycle. And there's one in a classroom right now, and they had a monarch come out yesterday, so it emerged out of the chrysalis. And so we also have big milkweed plots, so... and growing milkweed and selling it to help support an after-school program. So,
when we were talking about habitat the things that would make up that habitat, what besides milkweed do monarchs require to be healthy and thrive?
Well, you need to have a variety of plants that they can use for, plants that you would plant for any pollinator. They need... some nectar, especially in the fall, so because that's a big deal. It's when they move to migrate, and so any kind of thing like that, and just fall blooming things, butterfly bushes, asters, and anything else in the middle, native plants that people can get are good. So any other plants that butterflies like is so. They do need the milkweed for their larval food plant, though. It's the caterpillars eat it. It's the only one they lay eggs on.
All right. So is part of the, we've talked a lot about pollinators in terms of bees on the program and about the issues facing them. Are there some similar issues for monarchs with the bees, Susie?
Yeah. Whatever we do to increase and help the health of the monarch butterfly population actually helps pollinators in general, all the pollinators that are in decline and in peril. So it's not just the monarch butterflies that need improved nectar habitat. So the more that we plant native plants that are good for pollinators, the better it will be for monarchs, that adult monarchs that need nectar for storing fat for overwinter, and for their flight, but also for all pollinators.
Okay, grab your headphones. I'm going to bring some calls onto the line here. We go first to Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking monarch butterflies with Susie, Linda, and Tom.
Well, you answered the question I originally had. So now I'm wondering what the neonicotinoids do to the, and whatever else they might use to kill off the milkweed that is essential for the larval stage and for the egg laying.
Okay, so neonicotinoids and their effect on the butterflies themselves, in addition to what they do to the bees. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate everybody's pointing at Tom, so I'll give him that one.
Yeah, it's a controversial topic right now. Neonicotinoids are the most widely used insecticide in the world. And unfortunately, they're systemic, which means they travel through the plant after application and they actually get in the nectar and the pollen. So they think they're a major reason for the colony collapse disorder of bees, as you mentioned, and we also suspect they're part of the problem with monarchs. But, it's a real politically sensitive thing right now.
Were neonicotinoids embraced because they were seen as safer than whatever came before them? I'm just curious about why they've gotten to be so widespread in their use.
Yes, they were, and you could apply them at low levels, so they actually apply them many times to the seeds. And so they thought by doing that it limited the exposure, but what they didn't realize being systemic is that it moved throughout the plant. And actually, Portland had a couple of big episodes where they sprayed linden trees and had, you might have read about it, a big bumblebee die-off. And the Portland City Council has now banned neonicotinoids from any use in the city. And I think that's one of the first places in the U.S. where they've done that.
All right. Another call here from Peter in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking monarch butterflies.
Hi. I was calling about actually sprouting the seeds and wondering whether they need to be scarified or stratified, if you know those terms, or what it takes to grow them.
All right, some sort of manipulation in the process before you get them into the ground. Thanks for that question. Susie seems to be the one to take that one on.
Yeah, sprouting and germinating milkweed can be kind of challenging. It's quite different than growing germinating garden vegetable seeds. So they need a period of cold, moist stratification that mimics the cold, moist stratification they would get in nature. So you can't just plant a milkweed seed in April or May and expect it to germinate. You need to either overwinter it in a natural setting in a pot or in the soil, preferably planted by December or January to get several months of cold, moist outside, or you can mimic that in the refrigerator, but that's a little bit more of a involved process.
So how do people obtain seeds? And for example, do Southern Oregon Monarch Advocates make the seed available to people?
Yes, we're going to do that, and there's if you go to their website, it's somonarchs.org.
Yes.
We're going to be distributing seed. In fact, we're collecting and processing seeds right now, so we'll have native seeds available so they can contact us through the website.
Native seeds, so are there different varieties of milkweed that are different that respond differently in different places?
Yeah, there's three different kinds of milkweed in Southern Oregon and Northern California in our region. There's the narrowleaf milkweed that you see commonly in the Rogue Valley, and it grows along roadside ditches and riparian areas, disturbed sites. The showy milkweed, which has a little bit broader leaf, and it also is common in the valley bottom. And then there's a rarer form, the heartleaf milkweed, that grows more on rocky substrates and foothills and mountain regions in our area.
And is any one of them any better than the other?
The monarch butterfly, there's a lot of native species of milkweed throughout the country, and the monarch butterfly uses every single one as they travel on their migration. So, you know, as Southern Oregon Monarch Advocates, we advocate for people to plant regionally appropriate native species, but the monarch will use any of them. And then I also have Climus siscus native seeds, so that's a business I own, and you can get nectar plant seeds through me too.
So do they eat just milkweed, or do they eat other things? Or?
The larva, the caterpillar, only eats milkweed. That is the only thing. Basically, it's a symbiotic relationship. The monarch needs milkweed to survive in the larval stage. It's the only they eat the milkweed, which contains a toxin that helps the butterfly be more resistant to predators. So the monarch is dependent on milkweed in the larval stage. But as an adult, the butterflies you see flying around, they require nectar for sugars and protein and fats.
Interesting. So the defense mechanism for the larva is to eat something that's essentially poison to every other creature but it.
Exactly. There are a few things that will still eat it, but it really helps it.
Monarch butterflies, the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange. Three guests from the Southern Oregon Monarch Advocates, Susie Savoy, Linda Kappen, and Tom Landis. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions, comments, and backyard observations of monarch butterflies. 800-838-3760, the number to call around the region. The email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So it was mentioned early on that it sounds like we're not very clear on the life cycle of the monarch in this part of the world. Is that a fair assessment? We're not completely clear on where it winters and that sort of thing?
We're unclear. We're not sure how they migrate. These real small insects that weigh about half a paperclip can travel 40 miles a day. One that Linda tagged last fall ended up down in the Bay Area. So we're just not sure where they go. They're constantly on the move, and there are four generations per year. So what we're trying to do with tagging is find out how they migrate and where they migrate.
So what are the cycles? I mean, when are monarchs in their various stages of life?
Well, they usually arrive here in the spring from their overwintering sites from either maybe Mexico or mostly California. They come here, and by the time they get here, it's probably the second generation of the four.
So it's the children of the ones that overwintered?
Yeah. And so by the time they get here and they start laying eggs, they start moving northward. And there are also four stages in the life cycle of a single monarch, too. So, and they migrate north. They made it all the way to Canada this year, which was very happy for Canada. They liked that. And we have, we had one northward movement tracked this last spring. We tagged some monarchs at Eagle Creek along the Trinity River on May 24th. And in late June, it showed up in Twin Falls, Idaho. One of them was found 439 miles east-northeast.
Wow, they really do travel some distance.
For northward movement, which is a big deal. So it tells us a lot. And there's been a lot of southward movement, by the way, through Utah, which suggests a Mexico, that some of our monarchs do go to Mexico.
Is there a northward expansion of the range as climate changes? Because I've certainly heard of this happening with birds appearing in places that they're not usually appearing in. And I wonder if the butterflies are doing the same thing.
What's interesting, we for the first time, two different people in the Portland metro area found caterpillars. So this is all new. So, yes, they are actually moving north, and I heard they were even as far as Vancouver. So there certainly could be something to that. And basically, wherever you plant milkweed, you have a chance of finding caterpillars and having them use it. So, yeah, it's been interesting.
We mentioned that it's usually the second generation arriving back from overwintering. How long do individual monarch butterflies live?
Well, as Linda mentioned, there's multiple stages. So as the monarch will lay an egg on a milkweed plant, and the egg usually is in the egg stage for 3 to 4 days. And then the caterpillar hatches out of the egg, and that's 10 to 14 days. And then the chrysalis is another 10 to 14 days. And then when the adult emerges, it depends on where it's at in the migration of how long the butterfly lives. So during its migration northward, the butterflies only live 2 to 6 weeks. But when they go to their overwintering grounds with the stored fat after nectaring, they can live up to about six months or so as overwintering. So those butterflies are the longest living, but the ones that within the migration have a shorter lifespan.
So they really have, in essence, fattened up toward the end of their lives.
They have to.
All right.
So, and also on that, some monarchs will take up residence in some of the areas here without moving northward or anything. They'll just stay around in the same spot, breeding and, you know, become resident type monarchs that don't migrate further.
In fact, one of the things we've noticed is that when we've released monarch butterflies in our own backyard way stations or with school, Linda at the school, a lot of times we find that the males will actually stick around the milkweed patch and wait for a female. So if a male emerges, they may not actually even migrate. They may just hang out and spend their 2 to 3 weeks or 4 weeks that they are alive at one single milkweed patch.
Huh. So flexible, certainly, in their behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
I got some more calls here. Al in the Applegate, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Susie, Linda, and Tom.
Good morning. I've been keeping milkweed on my property for about the last 20 years on an irrigation berm, and it's actually a perennial, and it comes back every year. You don't have to replant it once you get a colony going. I usually pick up my caterpillars in their last instar and keep them inside because there are a lot of parasites, wasps and flies that will lay eggs on them, and you know, when they pupate, it will destroy the pupa. So it's kind of nice to watch them and keep them as they're, you know, entering that last stage as a caterpillar. I know that milkweed has digitoxins and it's poisonous to most mammals, but you can eat some parts of the plant. With the immature seed pod, you know, before they get all silky on the inside, you can break those seed pods open and actually eat the seeds and the filaments when they're very young, and it's pretty sweet and it tastes good.
All right. Interesting observations. Thanks for that, Alan. Appreciate it. Good to hear from you again. Observations from our guest?
Oh, yes. Lots of observations of parasites and diseases within the rearing process. Tachinid flies are a really big problem. So it's a native fly that is a pollinator itself, but it actually the larva for the fly will actually grow within the caterpillar of the monarch and it will kill the caterpillar. So a lot of times, he's experienced, if you find a caterpillar on a milkweed patch and you bring it in to protect it during its larval stage, you may find that it has the tachinid fly.
All right, another call here from Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, where we're talking about monarch butterflies.
Thank you. I grew up in the Midwest, so I'm familiar with monarchs, and I have a lot of plants that the pollinators like, but this is the first time in my 50 years in Eugene that I saw a monarch butterfly twice this summer, and I was wondering if this has to do with their increasingly northward migration.
Thank you for that, Anne. Appreciate it. Linda, you were making a motion.
There seems to be a lot of monarchs this year. This whole season has been really a lot. And I have talked to other people in Eugene that have planted it, actually plants from me, and they planted them in a spot where they could find them again. And they actually did see some caterpillars on them this year. So there's been several reports from the Eugene area and northward Portland, like Tom said, of people finding monarchs and seeing monarchs again more than in the past. So this year has been a very, very good year. And what we can attribute that to, I don't know. It could be us all paying attention and feeding them, and it could be the weather patterns or the climate change also.
I'd like to mention that the compounding effect of people actually providing habitat and rearing them really does, we feel, can contribute to the overall population. Tom, how many have the Southern Oregon Monarch Advocates released this year?
Yeah, as of early September, we've released 1,000 monarchs, and I think by the end of the year, we'll be way above that. So, and that's got to make a difference. Plus the habitat, I think, just as Susie said, creating the habitat is attracting them, so, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I have more questions for you, so we're going to shove the Writer's Almanac back just a bit. We'll cut to the break right now, and then when we come back, I just have a couple more questions for you before we let our monarch advocates go. So stay tuned on the Jefferson Exchange. If you have more questions, call them in to 800-838-3760. We'll take a little more time talking about monarchs. You can also send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Back to talk more about monarchs in a minute five. We did have, she dropped off the line, but one caller wanted to know how to get in touch with Southern Oregon Monarchs advocates by phone, because she doesn't have a computer.
We don't have, unfortunately, there is no phone number now, so it's just online.
All right, but Linda's making a motion, like you might have something?
You can get in touch with me if you have any questions. I have people calling me all the time, and okay. That's just what I do, provide information, too.
And what's your number?
My number is 541-659-6927. Mm-hmm. That's the cell. So
okay.
It might take a day or so to get back to you.
Okay, 541-659-6927 to get a hold of Linda at Southern Oregon Monarch Advocates. So are the monarch butterflies in enough trouble population-wise to be considered for listing?
Yeah, their conservation groups have petitioned to have them listed under the Endangered Species Act to be protected and have habitat to protect habitat and to improve their populations. And it's one of those things where, you know, usually when we talk about endangered species, you feel personally like you can't really do much about the plight of the polar bear or these other far-off endangered species. But the monarch is something you can do something about, this species in peril right in your own backyard. So it's something tangible. It's something real that you can do with your family, your kids, your school groups, your community organizations. So it's something that is a really positive thing you can do.
So they can get seeds from you to make a monarch wave station. What are they going to do besides plant milkweed? How much of it? What part of the yard? That sort of thing.
Any amount you do will, you will be amazed. They will use a single plant, but the more you plant and the more you provide, the better.
Okay.
The main thing is just get it in a sunny location. It's one of those plants that likes full sun, so it doesn't do well under shade. But other than that, any soil type, it seems to do well.
And it is drought tolerant. It needs a little bit of water to help it flower and everything, but it's drought tolerant. It's mainly deer tolerant. Deer will occasionally eat it, but it's mainly deer tolerant. So it's actually once you get it established, it's a fairly easy plant to grow.
So in addition to discussions of listing, I understand there was a recent meeting with monarch advocates and a couple of federal agencies that can certainly help in assisting monarch life cycles. What was the result of that meeting?
Well, this was organized by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Grants. We met in Grants Pass. The Forest Service attended, BLM. And I think there's just kind of a groundswell. A lot of these agencies are getting funding coming down from above. They're wondering, you know, what they can do. And I think they've been impressed by what we've done here in Southern Oregon. So that's why they organized the meeting, was mainly to see what we are doing and how maybe they could help us.
Okay, so it's slmonarchadvocates.org?
slmonarchs.org.
slmonarchs.org. Okay, slmonarchs.org. And you can call Linda at 541-659-6927. Thanks for volunteering to have people call you on the phone. So it's Linda Kappen, Tom Landis, and Susie Savoy from Southern Oregon Monarchs. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.